Go to our homepage to order or call Rick's Satellite at 816-228-1801. First Amendment Radio receives no compensation for this service. Hear it first on FirstAmendmentRadio.com and FirstAmendmentRadio.net, around the world and on satellite.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us tonight on Sweet Liberty. Today is Monday. It is the 30th of January in the year 2005. And, of course, as you probably guessed, you're not listening to Darren Weeks tonight. I'm not, quote, filling in for Darren. I asked him for the time this week because I'm Jackie. That's true. And I asked Darren for the time this week because, as I mentioned last Wednesday night, I'm reading a book. And actually, the book, the title of the book is The Real Hitler, and it's written by B.S. Harrell. What I wanted to share with you is information that I've been reading about World War One and what happened to Germany, to the German people, after that war. And you know, I was thinking about this tonight, a couple hours before going on air, while I was doing some dishes. Why am I doing this? Sometimes I question when I get this impulse, if you would, or compelling to share certain information with you. Alan Watt has normally been guesting or co-hosting on Sweet Liberty. We've been doing that for quite some time. And Alan would probably say, well, this is irrelevant, because he has said that at other times. And we don't always agree on everything, as you are well aware if you've listened to our broadcast for any length of time. It was relevant to me, and that is why I'm sharing it with you. And you know, when we talk on Sweet Liberty, and especially with Alan, we've learned so much about ancient history and about the system that we're living in today, and how long ago, not just the plan for today, but for how long they've had control of the minds of people and the actions of people, right down to the entertainment, to the entire culture of nations. It has been orchestrated, it appears, since time immemorial by a few elite. It's much easier for them to do it today because of the media, mass media. But when I read information like this about recent history, what it does is, number one, it confirms to me what we've been talking about. It's, you know, we can hear these quotes from the ancient Greeks and not disbelieve it, but really have no foundation, in a sense, to be able to take it in and really grasp it. And then when I read some things about more current history, if you would, not ancient history, and you see the lies that we've been told and how our beliefs are established by the mass media today. And that's been going on since I've been born, and I'm sure since you've been born. I remember believing that Adolf Hitler was the devil incarnate. And it was very shocking to me when I began reading other material, suppressed material, that there's a whole lot more. I know that there's a lot that I am not aware of, that I don't know, but I do know that we've just been the lies that we've been told about history. And that's why I want to share this with you tonight. And if you would give me about 30 seconds, I'll be right back. Usually begin our broadcast with a spiritual message, and tonight what I wanted to do, this is very precious. And I'm going to share some of it with you. I ran out of ink actually while it was printing out. This is a group of professional people posed this question to a group of 4 to 8 year olds. The question is, what does love mean? The answers they got were broader and deeper than anyone could have imagined. See what you think. Little Rebecca, age 8, said, "When my grandmother got arthritis, she couldn't bend over and paint her toenails anymore. So my grandfather does it for her all the time, even when his hands get arthritis too. That's love." Billy, age 4, he said, "When someone loves you, the way they say your name is different. You just know that your name is safe in their mouth." Carl, age 5, said, "Love is when a girl puts on perfume and a boy puts on shaving cologne, and they go out and smell each other." Chrissy, age 6, said, "Love is when you go out to eat and give somebody most of your french fries without making them give you any of theirs." 4-year-old Terry said, "Love is what makes you smile when you're tired." Danny, age 7, "Love is when my mommy makes coffee for my daddy and she takes a sip before giving it to him to make sure the taste is okay." Emily, 8 years old, "Love is when you kiss all the time. Then when you get tired of kissing, you still want to be together, and you talk more. My mommy and daddy are like that, and they look gross when they kiss." Bobby, 7 years old, he said, "Love is what's in the room with you at Christmas, if you stop opening presents and listen." 7 years old. Nika, age 6, said, "If you want to learn to love better, you should start with a friend who you hate." Noel, age 7, "Love is when you tell a guy you like his shirt and then he wears it every day." Tommy, age 6, "Love is like a little old woman and a little old man who are still friends even after they know each other so well." And Cindy, age 8, said, "During my piano recital, I was on a stage and I was scared. I looked at all the people watching me, and then I saw my daddy waving and smiling. He was the only one doing that. I wasn't scared anymore." I thought those were very precious. I wanted to share them with you. Now, in this book, what I'll do right now, if you want to grab a pencil, is this book is quite interesting. I'm not totally finished with it. It's not real long. It's only about 190 pages. But it's in a, I think, a 6x8 format. This is written by V.S. Harrell, H-E-R-R-E-L-L. And there's an address here. This book was given to me by my friend Jeff. This is published by the Nationalist Free Press, P.O. Box 310, Kodak, K-O-D-A-K, Kodak, Tennessee, 37764. This man that wrote it is a white separatist, and I'm not a white separatist, although I do agree that what do I agree? Maybe I'm beginning to realize. I have begun to realize that it seems by design. There's getting rid of the white race, mixing the white race with every other color seems to be part of the design. And that's what a white separatist is, not like a white supremacist, as far as I understand, believing that, quote, the white race is supreme. But anyway, I was trying to figure out where to start here. And the First World War, and I never knew why Germany actually got involved in the First World War, because the assassination of the Archduke Ferdinand took place in Sarajevo. But they had Germany had a treaty with them, an alliance, and when war broke out, Germany became part of it. And I'm going to start a little before. The chapter I'm really interested in sharing with you is titled The Rape of Germany. But this is some background information for those of you who might not have heard it all or read it. And then we'll get into that chapter that was blowing me away when I decided I wanted to share this with you. This starts on page 47. Says, in the beginning of the war, things had gone well for Germany and Austria-Hungary. The Ottoman Empire was keeping the British busy in the south, and Bulgaria had entered the war on the side of Germany and Austria. With the Bulgarians, the Austrians were able to defeat Serbia. Italy abandoned its alliance and declared war on Germany and Austria, thereby joining the Jewish allies. Romania, Brazil, and China would also eventually declare war on Germany. However, this war was fought in a way no other war had been fought, and with new weapons. The consequences for all sides in terms of loss of life would be staggering. Still, by late 1916 and early 1917, things looked promising for Germany and Austria. By mid-1917, Russia was becoming a non-factor in the war, as the Germans were beating them soundly. This created great instability among the Russian government, and the communists, led by Jews Vladimir Lenin and Leon Trotsky, seized the opportunity to drive Nicholas II from power. The result was the revolution in November 1917. The communists seized power and set up a provisional government. But there was too much chaos, and they had suffered too many defeats to continue war with Germany. By March 1918, that was Grandfather Clock. By March 1918, Russia would be completely out of the war, having been defeated by Germany and giving up numerous territories, including Finland, the Baltic provinces, Poland, and the Ukraine. Though a defeat for Russia, it was still a victory for the communist Jews, who destroyed the House of Romanov and set up their own government. Nicholas II and all of his family, along with his family servants, were eventually executed by firing squad on the night of July 16, 1918, by a group of Bolsheviks led by Yakov Yurovsky on orders from his Jewish superiors. The Jews had succeeded in destroying the white Christian rulers of Russia, and in the years to come would murder millions more. And you think about it, folks, and I never thought about this till I began reading a lot of other material, but the wars that have been fought, so many millions and millions of white, quote, Christians were killing each other in the First World War and the Second World War, in the War of Northern Aggression here in the U.S., cousins, brothers, uncles, sons, we're all fighting against each other and killing each other. So when they say that they had succeeded in destroying the white Christian rulers of Russia, and in the years to come would murder millions more, that's just the tip of the iceberg, isn't it? Nevertheless, the victories on the Eastern Front meant that the Germans could move forces to the Western Front, which would give them an advantage in the stalemate with the English and French in the trenches. To ensure victory, the Jews needed help from the Americans. In America, there had been no public support for the U.S. entering the war, and many of those who did favor entering the war wanted to do so on the side of the Germans. I don't know, we've got it in the website at Sweet Liberty there, and sweetliberty.org. The First World War was actually planned, I think, in 1906, either 1906 or 1909. And they decided, this was from the Carnegie Foundation, they decided, they had a panel, they asked the question, if there was any way that they wanted to change completely a society of people, is there any way other better than war to do it? And they came up with the answer that there was, and make it impossible for life to ever be the same for the people. And war was the best way to do it. So they decided they would have a war, and they actually decided that they would start the war in the Balkans, which they did. Think about that. And I think that you would find that possibly in regional governance. At the bottom of that section, there are four testimonies that were given before the state legislators in Illinois. It was back in the late 1970s when they formed a committee and began to study the effects of regional governance. And it was Dodd. I can't remember his first name because I have a friend named David Dodd. But it was a Mr. Dodd who testified to this. And if you would like to read his whole testimony before that, the state legislative committee, I'm pretty sure you'll find it there in the regional governance section. So then we also find out that even though they decided back then that they were going to have a war, they didn't want to do it until the Federal Reserve Act was passed so the American people could pay for it. So in 1913, in December 1913, just before Christmas, is when the Federal Reserve Act was passed, and the First World War broke out in 1914. That's planning, isn't it, folks? And in America, there had been no public support for the U.S. entering the war, and many of those who did favor entering the war wanted to do so on the side of the Germans. A large percentage of the American population had immigrated from Germany and were sympathetic to its cause. Excuse me. Another large percentage of immigrants were from Ireland, who came to this country after the famine, or English Jewish genocide in Ireland, and they too favored entering the war against England. Even many American Jews, not fully understanding the full plan of Zionist world Jewry, wanted to enter the war on the side of Germany because they wanted to see the defeat of Russia. Woodrow Wilson had become president in 1913, and during his first term, he maintained a strict isolationist doctrine. And then they've got a speech here that I'm going to pass over that was given by Woodrow Wilson, August 19, 1914, declaring America's neutrality in the war. And then the author, after the speech, he said this was the public face of Woodrow Wilson, and it would be important for his reelection efforts in 1916, when he narrowly won based upon his campaign promise of keeping America out of the war. However, Wilson in private was doing a great deal at the pawn of the Jews. It is well documented how heavily the Jewish banker Bernard Baruch influenced Wilson. Do you know what they called it, Bernard Baruch? They called him Barney. That was his nickname. And you know that purple little creature that the children love so much? His name is Barney. And I wonder if that's just a cute little joke that they play on us, having a little mascot like that named after Bernard Baruch. It is well documented how heavily the Jewish banker Bernard Baruch influenced Wilson, as well as subsequent presidents Harding, Coolidge, Hoover, Roosevelt, and Truman. Baruch had been one of the largest contributors to Wilson's campaigns. Wilson appointed him to the Advisory Commission to the Council of National Defense, and Baruch became one of Wilson's closest advisors after the 1916 election. Baruch was head of the War Industries Board, which was responsible for, among other things, raising money for the American war effort once they entered the war. Woodrow Wilson, with his ring of Jewish advisors, spent his first administration helping the Jews secretly support the war and consolidate their banking power in this country. In December of 1913, Wilson signed the Owens-Glass Act into law, which, among other things, created the Federal Reserve Board. In 1902, the Jew banker Paul Warburg, an associate of Rothschild's, came to America and joined the banking firm Kuhn, Loeb & Company as a partner. His son married the daughter of Salomon Loeb, one of the Jewish founders of the banking interest. In 1910, Warburg drafted the plans for the Federal Reserve Board. This board would effectively give the power to create money to a small number of Jewish banks, taking it away from Congress. It also would have the power, not taking it away from Congress. You can't take something away. They acquiesced. Congress passed the Federal Reserve Act. Of course, they did it when most of the Congress, the U.S. Congress at that time, was on their Christmas break. It was passed by a handful that were present. But anyway, taking the power to create money away from the Congress, he said, it also would have the power to set interest rates and, through many other banking regulations, control virtually every bank in America. While ostensibly controlled by Congress, the Federal Reserve has always operated independently under control from the Jewish bankers who make up the board. Wilson appointed the Jew Paul Warburg to the board, and today the Jew Alan Greenspan continues this Jewish control over the board. With Jewish control over the banks established, the Jews were one step closer to be in a position to offer their Jewish brethren in England help against Germany and dictate both domestic and foreign policy. Jews in America by this time also had enormous control over the press. Jews like Joseph Pulitzer, a Hungarian Jew, owned important U.S. newspapers and news syndicates. Adolf Ochs, O-C-H-S, controlled one of the most important papers in the country, the New York Times. Together, the dozens of Jewish-owned newspapers throughout the country, both directly and through syndication, worked to shape public opinion into support of the war. And if you haven't seen it, I believe it's in our shadow government section at sweetliberty.org. Who controls America? It's about who owns the media. And we have there one there on the U.S., and also there's one in there on England. Behind the scenes, America began actively supporting the war, even as Wilson told the American public that America would remain absolutely neutral. In 1922, the U.S. government commissioned the Nye Committee to investigate reasons why the U.S. entered the war. They found that between 1915 and April 1917, prior to U.S. entry into the war, the U.S. had loaned England and the Allies $2.3 billion in support of the war effort. The committee concluded that the U.S. had entered the war against Germany because it was in its best commercial interest for England and the Allies not to lose the war, in its best commercial interest. In other words, the Jewish-controlled American banks had been extending enormous sums of money to England, France, Japan, and allied nations all along. America had not remained neutral during Wilson's first administration, but had been doing all it could to support the war against Germany while American newspapers attempted to sway American opinion against Germany. You know, folks, there was a book written, I think it was Germans Must Perish. Not Germany, but Germans. And that book was written and published here in the U.S. And think about all the German, American Germans, Germans who had emigrated into this country, who were American citizens and good. And when I say good, there's another word that I should be using. They contributed to this country greatly. And this book was written about how all Germans should be killed because they have this genetic thing about warring. I do not recall exactly how it was stated, but it was a whole book. And this book was promoted by the New York Times, Time Magazine, literally to stir up hatred against German people, not the country itself, against the people. And that book was circulating around the time before the second, or around during the, maybe during the Second World War. Now I lost my place. Oh, on April 6, 1917, America declared war on Germany in spite of the majority of Americans not wanting war with Germany. Nicholas II had just been deposed in March, and with Russian forces destabilized, American entry into the war was the key for an Allied victory. Wilson had been convinced to enter the war by Bernard Baruch and his Jew advisors at the Federal Reserve, who told Wilson how important a British victory was to the financial stability of the U.S., which by this point had loaned more than $2.3 billion to the Allies. This knowledge, coupled with the war agitation against Germany that the Jewish American papers were putting out, made Wilson's decision to go against his most important campaign promise in the election just months earlier made it more palatable to him. At the same time in England, the Jewish bankers made it clear to the Prime Minister that America's entry into the war was due to Jewish influence and demanded Palestine in return from England. This was the Zionist goal. But it required the British to do something unprecedented in the political history of the world. It required England to conquer, by military means, a territory legally held by another country, and then give that territory to a group of people who had no right or claims to it. The Jews, specifically Walter Rothschild, had told the German government months earlier that the Germans were considering offering the Jews a territory, and that if the Germans did it first, then Zionist allegiance would shift and the U.S. would possibly enter the war on the side of the Germans. But the British gave the Jews their assurance.
If you'd like to get a copy of this program, there are a few ways that we can help you. You may subscribe at FirstAmendmentRadio.com for only $45 a month, and you'll receive an MP3 CD weekly of all of our programs. As a bonus, we'll send you a password for our audio archives online. That's a $15 value. Or you may request any month of any program on one MP3 CD for a minimum donation of only $25. Or any single program on tape, MP3 CD, or CD for only $15. You may do all of this online at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Just follow the instructions to make a donation or subscribe. You may also adopt an hour of your favorite program. Please don't forget that most of the programs on FirstAmendmentRadio.com are listener-supported. Don't do Internet? Then call 559-781-3773 and we'll be honored to help you. Thank you from all of us here at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
If you read the history books, the most often asked question to Southerners was this: why did you fight? And the most often given answer is, because you're here. In other words, the South did not invade the North invaded the South.
Was it the Civil War or War of Federal Aggression? John Weaver sets the record straight in this DVD series on the Civil War from the Old Pass Christian History Conference. Was there a war to set the slaves free? Or was it a war to enslave us all? Get this DVD and judge for yourself. War of Federal Aggression. Get this DVD presentation for a donation of $25 from FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Order online today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Call 559-781-3773. The truth seems strange only because we've been indoctrinated with a fiction. War of Federal Aggression. Get it today.
Since the beginning of time, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it, it has been traded, it has been borrowed, it has been purchased, it has been stolen, there's a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty, to ourselves and to our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188 or visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, and regular guest, world-renowned economist Robert Chapman, right here on FirstAmendmentRadio.com at 4 p.m. Eastern or 1 p.m. Pacific Time. Visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net or call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, 1-800-375-4188.
You're listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com worldwide. Freedom is never free. We need your support today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Okay. I didn't hear the music, so I'm not sure. I'm going to start a couple of sentences back. But, folks, I wanted to remind you that Nicholas at First Amendment Radio is offering the entire year, 2004, all the Sweet Liberty broadcasts. That would be for a week, and that would be over 150 broadcasts, over 150 hours for $120. That's less than a dollar an hour. And if you hadn't been tuned in then, and you may be a more current listener, you might like to have that. I'd love to have one of those myself, to be honest with you. So let me, and you can contact Nicholas. Either email him or call him at 559-781-3774. Or is it 3773? Yeah, I think it's, oh, geez. You better email him. So let me go back here. He's talking about, okay, The bankers made it clear to the Prime Minister that America's entry into the war was due to Jewish influence, and they more or less threatened them that if England didn't guarantee that they were going to get Palestine as a Zionist Jewish state, their, quote, homeland, that they would bring America into the war on the side of Germany. And, you know, I always wondered why Germany was treated the way it was after the war, you know, with the Versailles Treaty. Because Germany did not start the war, of course, and it was Mal Payne, one of our listeners who's very steeped in German history. he said, just take a look at the globe. They had to get Germany. They had to control Germany. And Germany was the either the gateway to the West for the Bolshevik communists out of the USSR, or on the other hand, it was a gate barring them. And in his speech, when Hitler declared war on the U.S. after the U.S. declared war on Germany, he said in that speech that the outcome of the war, that the entire continent of Europe was at risk. In other words, they were fighting the war against communists, or today it's known as national or socialism, democratic socialists, social, whatever they call it. Same thing, folks, just a different word. And then in that speech, he said, no, not just Europe, but the entire world, that the outcome of that war was that important. And if you have not read the speech, you can find it in our section called How Wars Are Made Behind the Scenes. But getting back to Palestine, Turkey at that time was controlled that area, and evidently the people in the Palestinians were pretty much ruled themselves under a sort of a home rule. And I remember reading about was it Lawrence of Arabia? Anyway, they called him the Young Turk. He was the one evidently leading the force over there. So while they were fighting the war in Europe, he was over there with British troops fighting for that land against Turkey. He didn't know what the ultimate plan was. And from what I read, when he found out that he had been used the way he had been used, that he got out of the army and just more or less, I can't remember, but he took some type of a menial position someplace. But you think about this, and I do recall reading one instance during the war where they were sending troops and equipment and weapons over there and putting their troops here in Europe at risk, terrible risk. And it was all done so that they could get control of that area and then give it to the Jews. If you're a new listener, I'm not a, quote, anti-Semitic, and I'm not anti-Jew either. My Chuck was a Jew, at least his mom was. I don't know if you're half or not, but according to them, if your mother is a Jew, you're a Jew. And he was the finest and good person that I've ever had the blessing and the privilege of knowing, let alone being with for 8 years. But the thing is, these elite, they call themselves Jews, and they take credit for doing all these evil things. And what it does is it causes the divisiveness between people. And so we have to keep in mind that it isn't the, quote, lesser brethren, as they call the common Jews that aren't in elite positions. They're lesser brethren. They have nothing to do with it, other than that because of their, quote, religion, they're constantly sending money to Israel, and they're doing everything they can to further the Zionist program. But it's because it's part of their religion. And I say they know not what they do. The same as some Christians who now call themselves Judeo-Christians, which is the oxymoron of the world. I just wanted you to know that this book is about Jews, because that's what the wars are about. And take a look, just take a look at all the advisors, if you would, in the Bush camp. And you know, when I hear people talking about George Bush and saying, oh, George Bush needs to do this and he needs to do that, people must understand, we must get the word out to all who will listen. The president today is a puppet. George Bush doesn't have a brain in his head. And he is nothing but a front man. He's a puppet, as has every president before him been, except those maybe who thought they were really president and decided they were going to buck the system, like JFK and Lincoln, and who was the other one? A couple others were assassinated. Anyway, we're going down here. So the British gave the Jews their assurance that they would get that territory. And it says the Germans were indeed considering granting the Jews a territory because they planned this as a solution to their Jewish problem. They wished, after the war, to drive the Jews out of Germany and resettle them. However, this was not really what the Jews wanted. They did not want to be driven out and resettled. They wanted to stay, to maintain their power in the nations they were already in, and then also be given a territory. This became a key piece of the deal with the British, as we shall see. In 1917, Edmund Rothschild said that he anticipated, quote, listen to this now, a time might come when the fate of Palestine could be in the balance. He said this in 1917. And I desired that the world should have to reckon with the Jews there at such a time. We did a good deal in the last 10 to 15 years. We meant to do still more in the years to come. Now, we have to use the opportunity, which will probably never return again. Charles Rothschild had, in 1916, first proposed the deal to the British, which led to Foreign Secretary Edward Grey's proposal in March 1916 that they establish a Jewish Commonwealth in Palestine. Grey had been a former member of the House of Commons, elected in 1885 as a liberal, at the time of the split in that party and the pushing out of Gladstone, who had previously opposed the Jew-English Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli because of his foreign policy regarding the Ottoman Empire. Grey had since, Ottoman Empire was what controlled Palestine at that time. Grey had since been a tool of the Jews, particularly the Rothschilds. He had served as parliamentary undersecretary for the Foreign Office under Lord Rosebery, the Liberal Prime Minister, who had married Hannah de Rothschild, daughter of the Jew banker Baron Meyer de Rothschild, and at one time was the richest woman in England. Herein lay Secretary Grey's allegiance. It had been Grey who, in 1907, secured the British Entente with Russia. It was Grey who, on August 4th, 1914, persuaded the English to declare war in spite of widespread opposition to the war in England. It was Grey who, in 1915, persuaded Italy to enter the war on the side of the British, breaking their allegiance to Germany. And now it was Grey who first promised March 1916 to the Rothschilds and the other Zionist Jewish interests in England a Jewish Commonwealth in Palestine. According to the Rothschild biographer Niall Ferguson, after this deal with Grey, the Jews, between November 15 and January 26, ironed out the details of what they wanted in Palestine with the British. By this time, Chaim Weizmann was living in England. This Russian Jew would go on to be the first president of Israel in 1948. Well, you know, in Doug Reed's book, The Controversy of Zion, he mentions that Chaim Weizmann, it seemed towards the end of his life, had begun to realize what the heck he was doing and pulled back and retired. And then when all this came about, he came out of retirement and became the first president of Israel. Through the Rothschilds, Weizmann had been introduced to several key influential British figures, and given their allegiance, including Lady Crewe, Lord Robert Cecil, and General Allenby, who later would secure Jerusalem for the Jews through military action. Wiseman was one of the key Jews who worked on the details of the agreement with England between November and January, at the same time that Wilson was reelected president in the U.S. With the details set, Jews in America delivered their end of the conspiracy, entering the U.S. into war against Germany, contrary to what the American public had demanded. Another important Jew was Herbert Samuel, who, at the time, was a member of Parliament representing the Liberal Party. Recall that Herbert Samuel was then owner of Shell Oil, a descendant of Marcus Samuel, who had founded Shell in 1833, and it was Herbert Samuel, whom American journalist William Dudley Pelley reported had financed the Serbian Black Hand faction that had carried out the assassination of the Archduke and started World War I. In January 1915, as a member of Prime Minister Herbert Henry Asquith's cabinet, Samuel wrote a cabinet memorandum entitled The Future of Palestine. In this memorandum, he first proposed the idea that England should create a British protectorate over Palestine and give this land to the Jews. After the war, when the plan of the Jews succeeded, Herbert Samuel became the High Commissioner or Governor of the British Mandate of Palestine. He served in this capacity until 1925, and ironically, as the ruler of Palestine, it fell to him to appoint the Islamic Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. He appointed Haq Amin al-Husseini, who later became the key figure in ending British administration in Palestine. A series of events that gave Israel to the Jews without any British influence at all. During this time, more than 100,000 Jews immigrated into Palestine. When Herbert Samuel returned to England in 1925, he later became the leader of the Liberal Party and, as such, controlled the political destiny of England for several years, creating the entrenched Jewish power in England that later made World War II a possibility. But in 1915, as a cabinet member of the Prime Minister, Samuel proposed that England take over Palestine for the Jews. This became policy in March 1916, when Secretary Gray issued in public this proposal, and the circle of Jews, including Chaim Wiseman, worked out the details over the winter months while Wilson was reelected. On May 7, 1915, German U-boats sunk the British ocean liner Lusitania. In the early months of the war, the Germans sunk only ships that were armed. A U-boat would surface, stop the ship, and search it. If it were unarmed, it would be allowed to go. All armed ships were attacked. Winston Churchill, then Lord of the British Admiralty, however, had ordered that all British vessels should be armed. The Lusitania was armed and was registered in the British fleet as Armed Auxiliary Cruiser when it entered service in 1914. Churchill had called the Lusitania 45,000 tons of live bait. In February 1915, Churchill began ordering merchant ships not to stop when U-boats surfaced, and these merchant ships were now armed. He also ordered that certain naval ships masquerade as merchant ships in order to lure U-boats to the surface. When the U-boat surfaced, they would attack the U-boat. These policies led to the U-boats, of necessity, engaging all British vessels, and thus the armed Lusitania was sunk. In fact, the Lusitania, which did carry civilian passengers, was being used on the trip to ferry 76 millimeter shells and millions of rounds of rifle ammunition disguised as boxes of cheese. Nevertheless, the British Jewish press ruthlessly attacked the Germans in their papers for this and vehemently lied. After the Führer, the Germans abandoned this practice of unrestricted submarine warfare in order to try and win back public favor. However, according to the rules of war, that then existed, the Germans were in their right to sink the ship. Folks, if you want to read more about that, I don't know if you've ever read the book Lusitania, but that was a very interesting to see how they did it. They literally were sending those people to their certain death, the passengers, and at that time, the German government had paid for newspaper ads in 50 U.S. newspapers, mostly on the East Coast. And what I read was that the only paper that actually carried the warning was a Des Moines, Iowa newspaper. But it literally warned people not to sail on the Lusitania because that there was warfare between England and Germany. And what they did is had the captain, that he actually was, they rerouted his route, his path he was taking, into a known German submarine, a nest of German submarines. So they knew that the Lusitania would be attacked. They knew it would be sunk, and they used that to get the American people in an uproar so that they'd be willing to go to war. But actually, it took them 2 years to do it. See, it wasn't so easy at that time to fool the people the way they're doing today. Let me get back to this book. He says, we see here how important the role of the media is in defining public policy and public perception. The Jewish press in America sought to make the Germans look like the bad guys for sinking the Lusitania, a passenger ship that carried some American passengers. The Jewish American papers made it look like the Germans had, in effect, assaulted Americans when they sunk the ship that carried 128 American passengers. However, the newspapers could have just as easily, and should have, if they reported the facts honestly, made the British out to be the bad guys. Imagine the headlines. British use American citizens as bait, or British use American citizens as cover for the illegal shipment of war materials. This, in fact, was the case. According to Colin Simpson, who wrote The Lusitania, these war materials comprised a contraband and explosive cargo, which was forbidden by American law, should never have been placed on a passenger liner. Furthermore, imagine the furor among an indignant American public that a good journalist could have created by reporting how Winston Churchill was using passenger and civilian merchant ships as bait for German U-boats, in direct contradiction to the rules of war that then existed. This was the interpretation that the facts surrounding Lusitania demanded from an honest journalist, and this circumstance alone proves that the Jewish American newspaper syndicates, following the lead of the British tabloids, who had blatantly lied about the incident, sought to propagandize and sway the American public in the most repugnant and morally reprehensible way imaginable. The Jews printed army recruiting posters that featured a large, bloodthirsty gorilla wearing a German hat, carrying away a young blonde girl with her shirt ripped off and her breasts exposed. The Jews were trying to turn the tables on the Germans with their evil and pornographic propaganda. Germans were fighting to preserve the virtue and purity of their German women, and yet this army recruiting poster made the Germans, not the Jews, appear to be the violators of German women. You know what I'm going to do? We're just about out of time here tonight, and we are just about to the chapter called The Rape of Germany, which I want to get to. And I'm going to jump ahead here. He mentions the Balfour Declaration. And there's one thing here, though, that I want you to hear. In America, President Wilson had in 1916 rewarded his longtime supporter and advisor, Louis Brandeis, with a seat on the Supreme Court. Brandeis had been chairman of the Provisional Executive Committee for General Zionist Affairs in 1914 and had been a powerful influence in Wilson's two elections to the presidency. After the Balfour Declaration, Brandeis used his influence on Wilson to encourage him to support the new Palestinian state and World Zionism's goals for it. After the Declaration, Brandeis wrote a letter to Richard Gatheil, president of the Federation of American Zionists, in which he said, "With the Declaration and the British advance in Eretz Israel, there is ground for congratulations. The Jews had won their war. The war, which had killed nearly 9 million soldiers and 13 million civilians, 21 million people, also led to a unique set of epidemiological circumstances, which led to the death of another 20 million in the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic. So nearly 41 million people died as a result of this war. But nevertheless, the cataclysm that pit white Christians against white Christians was a cause of celebration for the Zionists." Constance Rothschild, listen to this, wrote a letter to her sister on November 7, 1918, in which she admitted to feeling, listen to this, quote, "quite giddy when I read the morning papers with all the wonderful news. Everything topsy-turvy. A gigantic cataclysm. Rather a kind of Alice in Wonderland or Through the Looking Glass effect. I seem to be always seeing emperors and kings and their consorts running and their thrones toppling over. Is it not wonderful?" That was a quote. "Wonderful for the Jews, maybe," the author says, "but a horrific nightmare for the families of the 41 million people who had died so that Jews could increase their power and steal Palestine from the Arabs. With the Jewish Revolution in Russia, the communists had killed the white Christian rulers and seized power. In Germany and Austria, there were also Jewish-contrived minor revolutions, which in Germany caused the end of the German Empire, with Wilhelm II fleeing to the Netherlands, and the Habsburg Empire was also destroyed. Austria and Hungary were divided, and in 1919, Hungary had its own communist revolution. The Habsburgs were exiled. The Arabs, too, lost dearly, with nearly 1 million casualties, and they lost control of Palestine and other valuable and precious land. And the Islamic people were insulted and degraded when a Jew, Herbert Samuel, was appointed the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. Yet the worst was yet to come, for the Germans and the Russians would see a Holocaust of over 40 million white Christian Russians under the regime of communist Jewry. That's the end of that chapter. Tomorrow night, we're going to begin the chapter that led up to this, folks. Thanks for being here tonight. God bless you. Good night.
Record budget deficits, bankruptcies galore, and the U.S. dollar is at an all-time low. With today's gloomy economic outlook, safe investments are often hard to find. For over a decade, Melody Cederstrom at Discount Gold and Silver Trading Company has been helping people secure their future by investing in the precious metals. Melody has the honesty, integrity, and experience that is often lacking in the precious metals business. Let her put it to work for you. Call Discount.